to Louisiana Lefty, a podcast about politics and community in Louisiana, where we make the case that the health of the state requires a strong progressive movement fueled by the critical work of organizing on the ground. Our goal is to democratize information, demystify party politics, and empower you to join the mission, because victory for Louisiana requires you. I'm your host, Linda Woolard. This week's episode is part two of my conversation with Lamar White Jr., publisher of the Bayou Brief. We continue our discussion on Huey P. Long in the context of modern politics, explore some of the accusations made against him by his contemporaries and scholars, and touch on some of the other topics of Lamar's writing. If you missed part one, please give it a listen, and then join us as we pick up where we left off with my question to Lamar of whether Huey is deserving of his own Broadway musical.
Yes, I think it would be a great musical. I think that the story is all there, that you have the right elements where heroes become villains and villains become heroes, and you don't really know, you don't really have the full appreciation of what principles and values are at stake until you have the benefit of hindsight. And just, that's the same, I think the same can be said with Alexander Hamilton, that that in the moment, the battles that he was fighting in the moment were very, it was hard to get perspective on them. But we know now, of course, that they were hugely consequential. And I think that, you know, hopefully, in my opinion, hopefully, the distance that we've had, this some 86 years since Huey P. Long was assassinated, I think that we should afford him a second look. And he was not the dictator, he may have had some autocratic impulses for sure, but he was not the nefarious tyrant or anything like that that the people of his time wanted to make him out to be. And I also just wanted to point out, like, you know, the villains of his day, they probably didn't see themselves at all like we see them today. I mean, I got into a little bit of criticism when I pointed out that the anti-Longs, Louisiana's a one-party state until really late 1970s. The Democrats controlled everything, but there were essentially two factions of the Democratic Party. There were the Longites and the anti-Longs. And the anti-Longs for a long time were, I mean, they really were the party of white supremacy. There's just no way around that. These guys were outspoken and open about their support of white supremacy. So yeah, I mean, I think history judges them very poorly nowadays, hopefully at least. And it would be good to see a more thoughtful. One of the criticisms I have about all the stuff I've read about Huey Long that's been, particularly stuff that's published by Louisiana historians, is how conservative it is, and how how hyperbolic it is. I mean, to so many of these people, he was like this horrible, horrible, you know, dictator who did all these horrible things, and it's like, what exactly are you talking about? And I think part of it is that he got tarnished by the corruption that happened 5 years after his death. So a lot of the people that were in his camp ended up getting in trouble. But it's unfair to smear him with the mistakes that others made that may have been supporters of him 5 years after he was gone. It really is unfair. And we did that to him for a long time. And in the 1950s, America in general was very conservative. And so the scholarship that was done on Huey back then, which was, you know, quite a bit of work, reflects that conservative bent, and that has informed a lot of scholars ever since. And it's unfortunate because it's not a fair treatment of Huey P. Long in any way.
Huey was a populist?
Yeah, Huey was a populist. His son Russell said that Huey was the best of all populists. And I tend to agree with him. Unlike Donald Trump, who was a populist, Huey P. Long actually won the popular vote every time he ran. He was a populist. I should say, I guess, technically he won a plurality when he ran for governor in 1928. And, you know, he didn't have to run in a runoff because it was a fait accompli. But it was obvious that the reason that he didn't have to run in a runoff is because he was, like, going to kill. I mean, he was dominating. He ran for governor actually in 1924 when he was only 30 years old, and he was only 13,000 votes short of making it. So, I mean, he was just, it's sort of remarkable to think about this, but the significance that he's had in shaping the state of Louisiana and defining the state of Louisiana and the folklore and all that stuff, not just our politics, but just the mythology of the state. He was only around for about 7 years. His career only lasted about 7 years. That was it. And
nonstop. He was nonstop for those 7 years.
Yeah, nonstop. Yeah, a body in motion.
How did his populism differ from Trump-style populism?
I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but in the same way that his populism also differed from the populism of Adolf Hitler or the populism of Benito Mussolini or Franco in Spain, these were right-wing nationalist, they were populist, right-wing populist, conservative populist, if you will, although that's also kind of unfair to say conservative populist. They were, I guess you could compare their autocratic impulses a little bit, but their politics were completely different. Huey P. Long believed in, and this is similar to Donald Trump. I mean, Huey P. Long was a champion of the downtrodden, of the marginalized, of the poor, of minorities. That was his base. That was his political base, and anything he could do to use his power and his voice to give the right to vote and to enfranchise, to empower, and to lift up the poor. That was his agenda. People thought he was corrupt, and again, it's just kind of an unfair treatment. He was impeached when he was governor. He was impeached for utter bullshit. It had nothing to do with, it had everything to do with him standing up to Standard Oil, and nothing to do with anything legitimate that he had done, that break any law or anything like that. He was never indicted of any crime. I shouldn't say that. He was indicted for defamation of character. He was fined $1 and it was just kind of a BS, defamation against some sitting politician so other than that, the man was not a criminal or, we've made the mistake of, judging him by the actions of his, successors. And that's unfair. And Donald Trump was just brazenly corrupt. I mean, just brazenly, openly, braggadociously corrupt. Almost,
Well, and you said it. Huey Long wanted to help the downtrodden. Trump presented as the populist candidate who was going to help the downtrodden, the forgotten man, as he called it. But really what he did was help his cronies and other people in his tax bracket
he promised to drain the swamp and all that stuff. And it ended up being even murkier and more corrupt and swampier than it ever had been before. I mean, I think that it's very possible that the former president will end up in jail by the end of his life.
I think that's possibly true. Although,
yeah, it's possible.
I don't know. He seems to be able to get away with a lot of stuff. Huey really expanded the charity hospital system. Mm-hmm. And you've talked about the anti-Longs. Bobby Jindal worked feverishly to dismantle the charity hospital system and privatize it. Was Jindal just a continuation of anti-Long forces?
Yes. Jindal was a continuation of anti-Long forces. Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. In the same way that Jindal was also just another iteration of the same platform that David Duke ran on in 1991. No one wants to hear that because of David Duke's associations with white supremacy and the Ku Klux Klan. But if you look at what their talking points were and what the agenda was, they're almost identical. Bob Mann wrote a great column about this in the Times-Picayune once, and it was spot on. It's just the same stuff over and over again. Again, like I said earlier, Mark Twain's quote, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. Yeah, and not only did Bobby Jindal, remember, not only did he want to dismantle the charity hospital system, privatize the hospital system, he also dismantled higher education very significantly. I mean, he almost bankrupted, if not bankrupted, higher education. LSU was, I mean, you remember that. I mean, you were living here. I was living here. In fact, the symposium on Huey Long's 75th anniversary of his death was held during the Jindal administration during all of this. And so it's so interesting to go back and listen to what these people are saying in the context of Jindal, right? Because they're kind of forlorn and distraught. Like, this is his legacy. He built this really robust system of charity hospitals and public education and higher education. And we're seeing all of this being destroyed by this, you know, charlatan in the governor's mansion.
Well, and the irony, we were talking before about the three pillars of progressivism being healthcare, education, infrastructure. Those are all job creators.
They're all job creators, yeah.
One of those things is job creators.
And they all help the everyday person. They benefit everybody. They really do. They benefit all of society.
It seems to me that in rural Louisiana in particular, Long-style politics could still do really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree. We just haven't seen that type of, Edwin Edwards arguably was the last governor that, not arguably, he was. I mean, Edwin Edwards was the last governor that really replicated the sort of populist mystique, the charisma, the magnetism, the electricity that Huey P. Long, and to a certain extent, his brother Earl, were able to generate. His brother Earl is a whole other part of the story, but he deserves a separate podcast because he in his own right is a different legend, but also a man who albeit had some obvious eccentricities and flaws, was someone who, just like his brother, was all about supporting the poor, the downtrodden, and lifting people up out of poverty. And, he was put into a mental institution while he was governor. That is true. But it was because he was cursing about a bill about segregation and about integrating schools. So he was on the right side of history on that.
Well, Lamar, I was thinking about this when I was reading your piece. It seemed like certainly wealthy people were not fans of Huey Long. It seemed like there were statements by doctors on more than one occasion that they wanted Long gone. It occurred to me, and I don't know if there are conspiracy theories that have suggested this, the doctors in charge of healing him after he was shot, has there ever been any concern that they didn't do everything they could do to heal him?
Yes. Yes, there have. Definitely there are a number of, I wouldn't say even that it necessarily conspiracy theories would be the right term for what we're talking about here, because his medical care was botched. And I didn't really get into that in the series I wrote, which I will get into and write a longer manuscript, because it is a part of the story. His anesthesiologist, for example, was a very adamant, outspoken, anti-Long guy who only 10 or 11 days before Huey P. Long was shot had joked that if he's ever under anesthesia in my room, my operating room, he won't ever wake up. Ha ha ha. And so there's that. And by the way, this guy also served, this anesthesiologist who was Huey's anesthesiologist. And there's no evidence whatsoever that he did a bad job, that he, in any way gave Huey poor medical care. This guy didn't. But he also served as a pallbearer for Carl Weiss. So, this is partly due to the fact that, The specialist that Huey P. Long had called for from New Orleans got into a car accident on the way to Baton Rouge, and it derailed their, you know, I mean, they were too late. He had to go into surgery. So they weren't able to be at his bedside during surgery or in the operating room. And, you know, they missed the fact that the bullet that he was hit by, obviously, it killed him. They missed the fact that it had hit his kidney, in the back of his kidney. And that ultimately is how he ended up passing away, I think. I mean, there's other theories about it, but yeah, there's a lot of scholarship on this, actually.
Okay.
Not a lot of records. There aren't a lot of medical records. They kind of covered up a lot of that stuff, but there's been a lot of doctors that have chimed in on this, you know?
So I've always hesitated to really embrace long in the way that a lot of Louisiana progressives do. The sort of idealized version of Huey Long as the progressive populist. And I don't know how much of that, you know, listening to you, how much of that is propaganda that was put out by the right, or how much of it is really that there were sufficient character flaws that we should really want a different, better representative of Louisiana progressive politics. Some of the charges leveled against him were corruption and nepotism. There were accusations of voter fraud in elections, vote rigging in the legislature, bullying in the legislature, patronage. One of the reports I read said that he got rid of people in state positions. And I get that you made the point that part of what he was trying to do was dismantle the political establishment, but that the people that he hired for those state offices then, he made them pay part of their salary towards his political campaigns. This is a report. I don't know if that's true or not.
The DDoC box, yeah.
He accused the press of being liars, like another populist we know. There was chaos around him that led to an attempted coup d'etat by his lieutenant governor, as well as an insurrection from his legislature. So there are things around him that make me uncomfortable, even as he did all these great things for the downtrodden, as we've been saying. So I know you say you have responses to all of that.
Yeah, I have response to all that. You know, it kind of always goes back to the fact that he came in and he was a disruptor, and he wanted to, this is what he was elected to do. This is part of his platform, was to basically dismantle the system that had existed at the time, which was a corrupt system. And the allegations of vote rigging and all of that, I mean, you know, that just, it's the opposite, frankly. This comes from white supremacists, straight up, who were threatened by the expansion of voting rights in Louisiana, and also from the old regulars here in New Orleans that controlled New Orleans, who were openly corrupt and anti-democratic. And so Huey Long was very much against, you know, the mayor here, Mayor Walmsley at the time, called him Turkey Head Walmsley, because this guy was, the machine politics here in New Orleans was such that, you know, only a handful of people really controlled the entire apparatus of government, of elections. So so that's one of the things he did, was he immediately came in and, yeah, he wrecked ship. You know, I think a lot of this stuff is our perception of him as this terrible, awful, corrupt, you know, backroom dealing, you know, someone who somehow made a fortune off of government, the government. That's another thing people say a lot, is largely filtered through the conservative press. And I would say, like, in fairness to him, with his attacks on the media, and he did definitely attack the media quite a bit. Some of it was way over the line, but it is also true that, like, the media was completely opposed to him. What he stood for was not in the best interest of the wealthy people that owned the newspapers, the big newspapers in Louisiana. There was a newspaper publisher who liked him, actually, but ended up not liking him eventually. So,
And like Alexander Hamilton, he started his own.
He did. He started a paper called Louisiana Progress, which is now a 501c4. Melissa Flournoy's 501c4. He renamed it the American Progress when he joined the United States Senate. But it was his. It was definitely his propaganda outlet. It wasn't a hard news source. I mean, you would not go there for, you know, it was a rag. But I mean, it was a way of countering a lot of the op-eds and the editorial positions of the main papers in Louisiana at the time. And he had a pretty substantial, sizable mailing list. Now, the deduct box, which we're referring to about the you know, people who worked for him had to donate a certain amount of their salaries to his political machine. You know what? It does sound really terrible. Obviously, something like that would never fly today. But it is worth pointing out that, number one, it was voluntary. I don't think anyone really actually opted out of it, but it still was something you could technically, you know. And it wasn't nearly as high as reports have, you know, suggested that, oh, it was 10% of your salary. It wasn't nearly that high. It was more like 1% or 2%. And a lot of people that worked for him at the time thought, or worked for state government at the time, thought that it was very much like paying union dues. And that's how it was, you know. So our perception of this back then, even then, it was like not, just, that was kind of how things were done. You know, it doesn't mean we can't judge him for what the ethics and the integrity of doing something like that. We sure can, but it's just important to note that, like, maybe our judgment's a little bit, maybe we have to just understand the context a little bit more, and also be mindful of the fact that, like, Huey P. Long faced an enormous amount of opposition from entrenched establishment people with a lot of money. You know, as Ted Jones said, the sort of Louisiana super lobbyist, the guy that founded DC Mardi Gras, the people who were Huey's enemies were far more corrupt and far more. I mean, there's no question, there's no contest, you know.
We
essentially lived in a plutocracy before Huey P. We lived in a plutocracy, right?
So he was working within the system that existed for his time.
That's right.
I should not judge him by today's standards in some way.
Right, right. You know, I think particularly with respect to the deduct box is what it was called. Like, put all the funds in the deduct box. I think that gets a little bit, that there's a mythology around that, because it disappeared after his death. And that was like, where did all this money go? But it's Seymour Weiss, by the way. Went to Seymour Weiss. He bought the Roosevelt Hotel with that money.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what the Long family believes. So if the Long family believes it, this is probably what happened to it.
So you would make the argument that I should embrace Huey P. Long as the progressive darling of Louisiana, a great progressive figure from our history.
Yes. Yeah. That has been unfairly maligned in many ways by a racist and classist white establishment. I think that, and then it carried on, you know, by these conservative white men in the history departments at various academic institutions over the last 30, 40, 50 years. Who perpetuated this really, you know, I mean, this is the perception that they probably were raised to believe because they're sure. White men and they're college professors. And that's inherently something that is an elitist, you know, you're inherently an elitist. So, yeah, I mean, and look, there are exceptions to every rule. And T. Harry Williams, who's a professor at LSU, wrote a fantastic book about Huey P. Long that won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. So, not everybody has been terrible, but yeah, the scholarship on him is really wanting.
Okay. Well, I look forward to your book this. Let's get back to your work. Your great aunts seem to have influenced a lot of your work.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. My great aunts, Manny Culbertson and Sue Eakin, were historians, both of whom became historians, you know, academics sort of later in life. My aunt Sue got her PhD when she was in her late 40s, early 50s, I think. And they co-wrote together. Sue was she had the PhD, and Manny was, you know, a history teacher, and one of her, like, she helped her edit and stuff like that. But they wrote the textbook that I used when I was and everyone in Louisiana, all the school children in Louisiana used. So if you're under the age of 40, you probably had this text, but between the ages of, like, let's say 20 and 40, you probably used my two aunts. Their textbook was Louisiana, the Land and Its People. And they were pretty cool. They were righteous white ladies from central Louisiana. My aunt Manny, they all grew up in Cheneyville or LeCount. And Sue ended up moving to Bunky. So she was from Bunky. Manny lived in Alexandria for most of her life, I think. But anyway, they were, like, righteous ladies. They were righteous in so many different ways. They were civil rights. Sue particularly was a civil rights pioneer, very outspoken. She discovered Solomon Northrup's book, 12 Years a Slave, when she was 12 years old. And it became her life's passion. Was rescuing the story. So yeah, I mean, I draw a lot of inspiration from that. I wouldn't say that necessarily their positions on anything have influenced me greatly. Well, I guess they definitely, it's part of my family, right? I mean, this is how I was raised. These values are what I was raised on. But just I'm just sort of inspired and in awe of what they were able to do, and in the fact that they did it without. There wasn't much fanfare or credit, you know. 12 Years a Slave became a movie and won the Oscar after Sue died, but she did know that it was becoming a movie, and that was really awesome that she was able to know that before she died. But she never really got a lot of credit because she was a woman, you know, frankly.
What do you mean when you say she discovered it?
So it had been largely, Solomon Northrup obviously published the book after he left Louisiana and was freed, and it had been largely forgotten. It was a huge bestseller when it first came out. It sold something like 30,000 copies. That was a lot back then. And then Uncle Tom's Cabin came out the next year, and just, you know, that was the book, right, that people really remember as what Abraham Lincoln said, "You're the little lady who started this big war," something like that, to Harriet Beecher Stowe. So people kind of forgot. And also here in Louisiana, in particular, Solomon's story, people just said, this is a bunch of baloney. It's a bunch of baloney. It's a work of fiction. Because he used people's real names. He identified, he called people out by name. And so it made people very uncomfortable in rural Rapides and of Oyles Parish, where this was set. In fact, some of my distant relatives and my ancestors, I guess, are among those who enslaved people in that region. The Turner family and the Ford family. There are a few of them that are still up there. And so, at any rate, like, she found this. She was, her dad, Daddy Sam, was visiting a neighbor, and took her with him. I guess they were probably in his car, in his truck, and they drove over to the neighbor's house. And My great grandfather, Daddy Sam, was a sharecropper, and so I guess they were doing something out in the farm, and they left the Sue. She was 12 years old inside of the guy's library, and she discovered, she said, "Find anything you want, and you can read anything in here. Just preoccupy yourself somehow with the book." And so she did, and she read. However long they were out, she was able to read quite a bit of 12 Years a Slave. So maybe the whole day. Presumably the whole day. She was there and she read the whole book in one sitting because he wouldn't let her take it with her. But it had such an impact on her when she read it at 12 years old that she kept trying to find it and could never get her hands on another copy until she was a college student at LSU. And she found a copy at Clater's bookstore, which is Dan Clater, the state senator's great grandfather's bookstore, maybe grandfather. But yeah, and so really the next next 70 years of her life was about confirming, verifying the facts in that book and proving that it was a true story, which she was able to do. And I'll say this because I'm on Louisiana Lefty, and why not? You know, her scholarship got co-opted by men. They made this historian out of Southeastern Louisiana University tried to take credit for all of her work, and they made her put a man's name on the book with her. It's my family doesn't really talk about it like this because they're too nice. They're nicer than I am. But yeah, I mean, it was like, this is kind of bullshit. Like this is a person who did tremendous amount of good and was not given her due until really after she passed away. Yeah, I'm also petitioning to have the New York Times write an obituary for her because they didn't. So, yeah. So my grandmother is their sister, and they had like seven sisters. There was like just a ton of them. In 1951, they were the American Magazine's Family of the Month. So they like American Magazine came down here and like lived with the Lyles family. They lived with them for like a week. And yeah, they're a really interesting family.
Wild.
Yeah. All the girls went to college. Every single one of them went to college.
All right. Well, yeah. I can see why they influenced you.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you got into writing about Huey Long because you're writing also about Carlos Marcello.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans mafia boss.
What made you start writing about that?
Well, honestly, I had not really been aware about how much of an impact and how huge of a figure Carlos Marcello was until relatively recently. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say that if you look through the archives of Louisiana newspapers in the 20th century, Carlos Marcello is probably maybe the third or fourth most cited person or referenced person or named person from Louisiana in those articles. So Huey Long or, you know, Earl Long or Edwin Edwards even probably surpasses him. But he was a huge, huge figure and also is somewhat of a myth. We created this monster of the, we exaggerated to the point of almost absurdity the evils of gambling and of slot machines and of all of this that now we consider just, it's totally legal and the state makes money from it and, you know, who cares? We turned into this monster and, you know, the truth is that Carlos is he's a very interesting person for a number of different reasons. Not the least of which being that the United States government actually illegally kidnapped him and sent him to Guatemala. And he, you know, somehow survived after like a month and a half in the wilderness. And, he's also associated with the Kennedy assassination. Now, I found that really fascinating that there could be a potential tie there. In my opinion, it's just a bunch of malarkey. It is funny because, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald's New Orleans native.
There's always a Louisiana connection.
There always is. But yeah, but Carlos Marcello was really one of the first true celebrity mafiosi when he was propelled into stardom in 1951 in the Kefauver hearings. He really was. He was a huge national celebrity. And the works on him have been really shoddy and really hyperbolic and exaggerated and all filled with all these conspiracies. And someone needed to come along and like clean this up and tell the real story.
So is this just a political history or is there some progressive politics in there somewhere?
Well, yeah, I mean, many ways he was look, I think that if he were around right now, he may have been a Trump fan, Carlos. you know, he wasn't a progressive champion by any means, but he was a victim of government. He was a victim of the government's, you know, the government went too far. I mean, just like we did after 9/11 against, you know, with the Patriot Act and against Muslims, and, you know, we were literally inspecting people's library books and what they were checking out at libraries. There was that against the Italian, particularly Sicilian Italians in America for a time. So I thought, you know, for one, yes, he's a victim of that, that whole nasty chapter on our history. But it's really interesting because it involves the Kennedy brothers, and it's like, how did they betray their values on this stuff? Why is it that we were led so deeply into this ridiculous war against gambling? And, you know, and he also, you know, there's plenty of Supreme Court cases with his name on them. And so he made a lot of like legal history, actually, which people would be surprised about. Not necessarily something he wanted to do, but he did, you know. I just think he was a misunderstood man.
I look forward to reading more about that. How do people plug into your work, Lamar?
Well, so I have a Patreon. I just started this a couple of months, 3 or 4 months ago. It's patreon.com/LamarWhite, or I think you just go to LamarWhiteJr.com and it'll redirect you right there. You know, that's where people can support my work, my research. It starts at $3 a month. And I'm going to try, I've you know, been sort of intermittent about this, but I'm going to try my best to provide regular updates to people about what I've been doing, and also to provide like some exclusive sort of stuff that I don't share publicly on social media. Like, for example, people who have followed me on Patreon, who have supported me on Patreon recently, I acquired a copy of the minutes of the meeting between Russell Long and Carl Weiss Jr. in 1985. It was a meeting that was supposed to have been off the record and confidential. And Carl Weiss Jr. actually went back and dictated the entire meeting, like what happened to his, I guess, presumably to his like physician's assistant, who then transcribed it. And it was put up in the Tulane Library and, you know, someone's archive. So that's the kind of stuff that I share. So there's additional stuff like that. Also make little videos, book recommendations, tell people about the stuff I've been reading. That's definitely how they can follow me. Or on Twitter, I'm at Lamar Y. Jr.
And then the Bayou Brief, people
Bayou
should...
Bayou Brief also needs support, arguably the most, because what I'm able to do there is to hire other people. So I spend the money there to really to pay for, you know... We've been kind of like in the last few months, there's been a little bit of a hiccup because, look, we had a hurricane and, you know, we're under a pandemic still in Louisiana. It's been a little bit more difficult, but we still have people that are writing, freelancers. So bayoubrief.com. The more, you know, every dime that goes there goes to supporting local reporting and, local long form journalism. And also, you know, Sue Lincoln's back. My all-star reporter, Sue Lincoln, is back in Louisiana. She took a couple of years off, a year and a half off, moved to California, and now she's back. So,
well, all right. And we have a joint venture on bayoubrief.com.
Yes.
Which is the organizer of the month. We did a mini podcast about that earlier on the Louisiana's Mightiest Heroes mini pod. We spoke about it, but you host the gallery of all our organizers
right.
of the month.
And it should be, you should be able to find that on both the desktop version of the site at the very top of the screen on the menu bar at the top. There's a link at the very top. It's the first link. And on the mobile version, if you scroll down a little bit, there's a little like image. You'll see it's a really pretty image with flowers. So, it's nice. It's a cool little, it's nice to be able to do that. I've got a couple other pages like that, that are just good resources. I have a whole Kingfish compendium page now too. people can check out, and a page on Clay Higgins. For some reason, anyone wants to check that out.
Well, the Kingfish Compendium page is very impressive. I looked through that.
Yeah,
there's a lot of good resources there.
Yes, yes. A lot of good resources. Yeah. I'm waiting to get my cease and desist letter from somebody. Like, you cannot use this. But so far, it's been okay. Knock on wood.
Right on. Well, let's get to the last three questions that we ask of everyone. Lamar, what do you see as the biggest obstacle for progressives in Louisiana?
I should have prepared for this, because I have listened to your podcast all the time, and I know what the three questions are, and yet I'm going to be completely winging it here. The biggest obstacle that progressives face in Louisiana are themselves. And I think that our Democratic Party right now is in shambles. I think that we're being led by a really conservative faction of the Democratic Party. Does not serve our state well at all. People who, you know, have espoused privately racist thing. Not, I mean, I shouldn't say the leader of the party has done this, but, you know, people that are in charge of this. This is a big issue. This is a big problem. It's a big hurdle. And if we don't have an organized and effective Democratic Party that's reflecting the views of the National Party and also is willing to stand up and champion the National Party platform, we are going to be without a lot of resources and certainly without a lot of credibility in the national arena. So I think that's the biggest existential threat. 12 years ago, right? We were in a very similar kind of situation with the party, and we did dig ourselves out of it. So it's just disappointing to see this happen again. And it's disappointing the way it was it's just all disappointing. The way it was framed, the racial undertones to it, the sexist undertones to it, all of it just sucks.
You feel that the progressive movement requires a functioning Democratic Party?
I think the progressive movement is most effective in a state like Louisiana. If we were in California, I may say something different. But a state like Louisiana, we need every freaking dime we can get. And without the without that national support, it's exponentially more difficult. So we turn that support over to people who are conservative leaning, but these are people who are, you know, openly espousing conservative leaning views and openly saying that they don't believe in the party platform. In big ticket issues on the party platform, like gay rights and abortion rights. This is what it means to be a progressive and what it means to be a Democrat. So I don't know why we're being infected with these anti-longs. You know?
All right. Breaking news from Lamar White.
I don't think anybody's going to be surprised by that.
What do you see as the biggest opportunity for progressives in Louisiana?
Let's see. We have a lot of, on the same hand, we have a lot of really good, particularly young African-American leaders in our legislature, that I think have a really good shot at becoming the first ever statewide elected, multiple people who in maybe 5, 6, 7 years from now, have a good chance of breaking through that really it's kind of a glass ceiling that we've never been able to break through, and getting someone who's a person of color elected statewide. I'm thinking particularly of Ted James of Baton Rouge, and I've been really impressed. I'm going to blank on his name down here in New Orleans.
Royce Duplessis.
Royce. Thank you. Both of them have been really impressive to me. And I also say Mandy Landry has been pretty impressive too, and she's my representative, so I really like the fact that I'm represented by her. Young, progressive woman here. So I don't think that the bench is as terrible as people claim it is. You know what I mean? We don't have a bench. We have a bench. We just have to encourage our bench. And one of the ways we can encourage our bench is to get a better Democratic Party. You know?
Well, I think that's a good point, that we do have a bench, and I think developing the bench with getting more people in these positions both legislative and even school board, all these local, all
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Local electeds.
Yeah.
I think
I'm just worried that the machine politics of New Orleans is struck a deal with the conservative political forces of Central Louisiana, Acadiana, and whatever. It just, you know, I know that the last chairperson was not the most popular of all, but I thought it was really cool for a while that Louisiana had African-American woman as our chair and an openly gay man as our executive director. And I thought that really meant something. I thought that was a good signal to send out to the rest of the country. I went to a couple of Democratic National Conventions, and I was always proud to be with them. They represented us very well, I thought, on the national stage. I can't say that right now.
Yeah. Lamar, who is your favorite superhero?
You know, I was going to say like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but I guess she's not really a superhero. I mean, you know, she's kind of
a superhero. She's up there. She's up there.
I don't really want to go for a cartoon character because I actually think there are real life superheroes. So I hate to like not say, oh, it's Iron Man or oh, it's Superman or it's Black Panther, because, you know, those are all good selections.
And there is a lovely graphic of a bunch of the Avengers with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's face.
I'm just saying
in the middle of them
could be my favorite superhero. I mean, she was a pure superhero. Like, it's kind of difficult to find a flaw with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Her judicial career was historic. Her decisions were great. She dissented on, you know, her dissents made history and changed, even her dissents changed the course of American jurisprudence. So that's a pretty good superhero. But, you know, also someone like Anthony Fauci, also really this year and the last couple of years, I think it has been elevated to superhero status in my book. And people that do that on a local level, to me, are superheroes as well. So there's a guy in my hometown of Alexandria named David Holcomb. He's a medical doctor, and he's been telling the truth about COVID to people who are very, very, very reluctant to believe in all of this. And I thought it was really cool because this year he was named Sinlaian of the Year by Sinla Focus, a publication in Central Louisiana. I thought that was really awesome that they named this guy who is, you know, in his early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. Usually they name people who are on their like deathbed, essentially, just Sinlaian of the Year. So people like that are my superheroes. Sorry, I'm not going to give you a...
There's no apologies needed. People give a wide variety of answers, and we leave that open. I will just point out...
You can say Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
You named Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Dr. Fauci, and both actually do have action figures.
Well, can I say both of them? Because I just want to say it's tied for both of them.
You can say this is a,
you know,
free form question.
Like I like Iron Man too because he's like
you fun. There's no pressure to pick.
No, I know, but no, it's RBG and Fauci.
Right. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Lamar, thank you so much for doing the show with me. I love having you on. And obviously, we've mentioned a couple of things along our meandering path today.
Yeah.
Where I think we're going to have some other podcasts to follow up. I can remember Earl Long, and then there was something else that I can't remember right now. But I know there were two things, at least, that we said, hey, we'll save it for another podcast.
Yeah. Uncle Earl, for sure. You know? So well, it's been great to be here. I mean, I knew we were going to talk forever. So apologies to your listeners who may have dozed off about an hour ago, but it's been fun.
Thank you for listening to Louisiana Lefty. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you to Ben Collinsworth for producing Louisiana Lefty, Jen Pack of Black Cat Studios for our Super Lefty artwork, and $1,000 Car for allowing us to use their Swamp Pop Classic Security Guard as our Louisiana Lefty theme song.